When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of I Know That Face, a podcast which honours the often underappreciated by the masses work of character actors. I'm Stephen Portia.
My name's Andrew Carroll.
But in this episode, we're doing something a little bit different. We're launching our own...
Talking about found footage movies.
No. I guess we're not really doing anything different, not talking about character actors. It's kind of...
Yeah.
It's kind of half our thing. And half now.
Yeah.
We're launching our own inaugural movies award show. I was thinking we should call it the Noes, because my first thought was the Faces, but it sounds a lot like feces.
That's true. It does sound a lot like feces.
But basically, our version of the Oscars.
I know that feces.
Hey.
This is gold.
One
man's face is another man's feces.
No.
Moving on.
Do you like the Oscars in general, Andrew?
No, not especially. You know, it's always exciting when Cillian Murphy wins. That's only happened once.
That's true.
Yeah. I liked it when Parasite won, but...
That was the best thing that ever happened.
It was, yeah. And then COVID immediately killed any kind of positive vibes. It's always fun when, you know, something you like wins, but it's important to remember that this is just sort of, you know, water off your back. You shouldn't get too annoyed about these things. Except, of course, when American Fiction wins, a movie that is total shit.
I like that movie.
It's dog shit.
I've been raving against it on Twitter and in group chats, and I've been silent until now. I like that movie. I think it's very good.
I know you like that movie. I saw your 4-star Letterboxd review.
It's
but
very
like,
funny, and the dramatic
it's not
stuff
funny.
Is good.
The dramatic stuff is
like
okay.
John Ortiz is funny?
Not really.
Oh, I like him.
Yeah, it's like it looks like a crap Netflix episode or something.
I agree to disagree.
Okay, well, I'll strangle you later then.
Read my Letterboxd review for why I liked it.
And mine for why I hated it.
On the positive side of Oscars, I will say, not to be too, you know, bashy about them, they're an event every year that revolves around movies that gets a lot of attention from the general public. So, like, I've had friends who wouldn't be huge movie buffs that are aware of Anatomy of a Fall or The Zone of Interest, movies that wouldn't typically be on the radar. Same with Parasite, which won Best Picture a few years ago. Like, that's a really good thing.
Yeah.
I like how the Oscars can elevate the people who are nominated or win at them. Like, I love that any movie with Barry Keoghan or Paul Mescal are in now, the trailer will say, Oscar nominee.
Yeah, Barry Keoghan.
And now Cillian Murphy will be Oscar winner, Cillian Murphy. And I do think, maybe not as much this year, but once in a while, there's a really good nomination that you didn't expect would happen. And you get really excited about, like, Paul Mescal in After Sun or Michael Shannon in Nocturnal Animals, which still rules that happened. And generally, I think the movies nominated are very good for the most part. But things I don't like about them. I think there's a perception that to be an Oscar-nominated movie, films need to be important. I'm using air quotes when I say that.
Raw. Necessary.
Yeah. And that leads to this kind of...
A film that defines our time.
Exactly. And it's important to platform. I understand the want to platform those kinds of movies. But I do think at the end of the day, this is a film craft show. So it feels a bit weird putting such dramas and biopics on such a pedestal and sort of disregarding comedies or horror or thrillers when, you know, that's a lot of what people
that's
like
your
to
bread
watch.
And butter,
and
yeah.
It's... a lot of them are oftentimes better made than the important movies that you're nominating.
And they often make a lot more money than these important movies.
So I've made a list of movies that have not earned a single Oscar nomination.
Right.
Breathless, Blowout, Don't Look Now, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, Heat, The Searchers, Touch of Evil, and then more recently, Uncut Gems and You Were Never Really Here. I would say all kind of defining seminal movies.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, absolutely.
And I hate the way Oscars dominate film conversation. Like, Saoirse Ronan had a new movie that premiered at Sundance this year.
Yeah.
Called Outrun. And people immediately were like, Oscar frontrunner for 2025. And it's like, this year's Oscars haven't happened yet.
Yeah.
Chill out. Like, maybe we'll just judge the movie on its own terms and we'll see where we are in like 8 months.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to solve this issue, but I really don't like the campaigning that goes behind Oscars because, you know, film companies will have one or two movies that they put all their money and weight behind to try and score some nominations at the expense of other possibly great movies. There was loads of stuff cases of that this year, I found, where A24 pushing the Zone of Interest, but at the expense of The Iron Claw and Priscilla, or Neon pushing Anatomy of a Fall, and to a lesser extent, maybe Perfect Days, but at the expense of Eileen, my beloved Eileen. And I just feel that this just leads to the same movie sweeping all the award ceremony nominations and these smaller, in many cases, equally great films, losing that added boost to find an audience.
Yeah.
And I just feel like by the time the Oscars roll around, I'm sick of hearing about these movies because they're
just the same ones
over and over again, like all the precursors to the Oscars.
And you're sick of seeing like the same stills from those movies on Twitter. Like there's the famous one from Killers of the Flower Moon and these are the kind of pictures you see for like 8 months and then never see again once the awards are over.
The only good one was the Paul Giamatti holdovers one where he's like...
And they're all really... Most of them are really boring stills that you instantly forget are sort of like... that are in the movie at all.
Yeah. Like that scene where he's sitting at the table. That's a pretty good scene.
It's a good scene, yeah. It's like the linchpin of the movie.
But I wouldn't define the whole movie
I wouldn't call it the most cinematic moment in that movie.
Exactly. And I think part of us doing this podcast, like my favorite thing about it is shining a spotlight on movies listeners might not have seen or might not even be aware of.
And then spoiling them for them.
Exactly. But I thought of us, you know, doing our own alternative Oscars might be a cool way of continuing that tradition. And we've been talking about doing more non-character episodes of the podcast every once in a while just to shake things up. So it felt like a good fit. How do you feel about this exercise?
Pretty good. I like all my choices. I think I'm given voice to some films that maybe our listeners haven't seen or weren't on their radar before. And I also I'm really looking forward to Here Are the Nominees.
Are you going to do that voice?
Well, I'm going to do a voice. I don't know which yet. I might just do like the female voice. This is Cillian Murphy's first Oscar win and second nomination or whatever.
Yeah, that's great. Continuing on what I said before, and I don't think you did this, but I think you basically kind of did. Just for me, to just not risk repeating what I may have said in our end of year episode, I followed in Mark Kermode's footsteps in that my nominations, I didn't nominate actors and movies in any category if they got an Oscar nomination this year in that field. So
I nominated them. I nominated a few just because I haven't seen as many movies as you and I needed to fill out some space.
Sure.
And we won't be talking about the nominees that much, I don't think.
But I think Zone of Interest is a masterpiece. And Oppenheimer was my favorite movie of last year. They're not in my best picture picks because they got nominated in those categories. But Sandra Huller did not get nominated for Best Supporting Actress for The Zone of Interest. So she's in my Best Supporting Actress category. You get me?
Makes sense.
And also, in keeping with the premise of the show, I have lots of notes on my Best Supporting Actor and Actress picks, where the real character actors are. Significantly less for the other categories, but we'll see how we go.
Yeah, I kind of whiffed on Best Picture, just because I figured you had at least two paragraphs, I have one, so...
I have my Letterboxd review printed
perfect,
off
whichever, yeah. Hey, listen, that's the point of the show where everyone just wants to leave and head to the bar.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We're only doing acting categories, screenplay categories, and Best Director, and Best Picture.
Yeah.
Great, okay, so...
But for the record, Godzilla Minus One would still win Best Special Effects at the Noise if I had my say.
Okay, great. Yeah. It was so great when they won. That was amazing.
Oh, yeah, it was great. Godzilla!
And they had the little...
The shoes and their little Godzilla statues, yeah.
Great. Let's do Best Supporting Actor.
Yeah.
Okay, do you want to do your picks first?
Yes. So, here are the nominees. David Krumholtz, Oppenheimer. Donnie Yen, John Wick 4. Robert Downey Jr., Oppenheimer. Dominic Sessa, The Holdovers. And Milo Machado Granier, who knows how you say it, Anatomy of a Fall.
I love a Machado.
We all love a Machado, yeah. A little coconut dusting. And the winner is David Krumholtz for Oppenheimer. Krumholtz. So Oppenheimer's his fair share of characters with their own senses of morality and ethics, which is in part what makes it such a rich film. You know, you've got Josh Hartnett, you've got Kenneth Branagh, Casey Affleck, Emily Blunt, Dane DeHaan, and Matt Damon all playing characters with distinctly certain or conflicted views on the Manhattan Project. And even characters as small as Josh Peck's manage to get across how they feel in only one or two scenes or sometimes even less lines than that. And that's why David Krumholtz's Isidore Isaac Rabi comes as close as any character can to being sort of the conscience to Cillian Murphy's J. Robert Oppenheimer. Not that Oppenheimer doesn't have his own conscience, but a lot of what he says a lot of what he thinks sort of lies under the surface.
Harder to read,
yeah. And so it's in the film Small Moments where we see this man who dearly loves his friend, despair at how his morals and ethics ultimately crash against the HeLa's force that is and would become atomic progress. And while no one is ignorant of the effect that the atom bomb will have on the world, Rabi is one of the first to know, and Krumholtz's weighty, weary performance really sells this. You know, so you can see, you feel the weight of every word when he's like, I do not wish the culmination of 3 centuries of physics to be a weapon of mass destruction. And even as he says it, he knows that it's for nothing and that he's a part of something bigger and potentially far more impactful than anything else in human history. And you just really feel that in Krumholtz's expression and delivery. And that's sort of what I think, out of everyone in that film and out of everyone sort of last year, he made the most impression of me as in a supporting part.
That's amazing. Yeah, no, yeah. He's incredible in the movie. Yeah. Really, really good. I'm great for a guy who I've seen in a lot of movies in supporting roles or very small roles, but memorable roles, getting a chance to shine and work with like one of the greats.
I think before this, I'd only ever seen him in The Santa Claus.
I think I've only really seen him in Superbad.
Yeah.
So.
And then seeing this, I was like, holy fuck.
Oh, I actually.
Buddy the Elf has got it.
I watched The Deuce on HBO, which he's in with Maggie Gyllenhaal. Yeah. I've always liked him, and I thought he really stood his own and really left a big impression. Yeah. I think if it wasn't such a stacked supporting cast, he would have gotten more recognition.
Yeah, absolutely.
If it wasn't Downey Jr. Yeah. and Matt Damon and.
Josh Hartnett and Dane DeHaan and Casey Affleck and Emily Blunt and Florence Pugh. And of course, everyone's favourite, Rami Malek.
Rami Malek.
Yeah.
That scene where he drops the papers.
Nerd!
Do you want to say anything else about your other supporting actor picks or anything? No.
No, yeah. I think Donnie Yen was sort of underrated last year.
Yeah, he's very fun in that movie.
Yeah, in action and in like... I have carefully crafted my Twitter algorithm experience so that it only gives me horror movies and action movies. And action movie Twitter were wild for Donnie Yen in that movie. He was, and in fairness, he has like that scene in the church with John Wick.
Oh yeah,
yeah, that's really good.
And the bit
really
where he's eating the food while he's in the big shootout that he's reluctantly taking part in,
and it really made me impressed with that character. Like I've eaten a full bowl of ramen before and just not been able to move, and he's like throwing kicks and like doing this wind up spinny punch and stuff like that. Oh, amazing stuff.
The bit where he shouts at Bill Skarsgård is amazing too. Remember where he's like, fuck you.
Yeah, yeah. Fuck off.
Yeah, yeah. That's it.
And I think the kid in Anatomy of a Fall, Milo Machado Graner, he blew me away with a couple of scenes
those two monologue scenes towards the end. He's actually on my list.
Yeah, you know what? Maybe I should have put in the prosecutor for that movie. That bit where she's
the two.
Yeah, bit where Sandra Hüller is like, oh, well, it happened like this. And he's like, no.
It's like, also the bit where that kid does the most like Titanic monologue I might have ever seen. Mm. And then the prosecutor comes out and goes, just want to remind everyone that that's all hearsay.
Yeah.
It's so funny.
A very misogynistic song. Anyway, take it away.
So I did a thing where, because I'm a glutton for work.
Of course.
If there was two performances in a movie I liked, I grouped them together. And if an actor was good in two movies, I grouped them together. So my best supporting actor picks are Charles Melton and Corey Michael Smith for May December, Josh Hamilton for Landscape with Invisible Hand and Reality, Forrest Goodluck for How to Blow Up a Pipeline, Kiefer Sutherland for The Caine Mutiny Court Martial, and Milo Machado Granier, Anatomy of a Fall. And the winner is Josh Hamilton.
Oh.
I thought he had a really great year with these plum supporting parts in Reality and Landscape with Invisible Hand, and also had a very minor role in Bradley Cooper's Maestro. But in Reality, he plays one of the FBI agents interrogating NSA translator Reality Winner, played by Sydney Sweeney, who is suspected of leaking an intelligence report to the media. And the movie's dialogue is noteworthy for being based entirely on the real FBI's transcript of the interrogations. And it's so compelling because it feels so authentic. And the interrogators, who are played by Josh Hamilton and Marshawn Davis, despite the intense situation, are being disarmingly casual and friendly. It feels to me either to make Winner feel like she can confide in them or get her to speak in a more casual way and slip up. But I was really impressed in particular with Hamilton because he doesn't look like how I'd imagine an FBI agent to look. Like, he's not a muscular guy. He's sort of styled in the film like a nerdy dad. He's got a shirt tucked into pants, glasses, skinny. And he's smiling and appearing genial, but there's something cold and clinical behind his eyes. Like, he's watching everything and clocking every detail. And every time reality slips up during the interrogation, the friendly facade just drops from Hamilton's face in a way that's really disorientating and haunting. And in Landscape with Invisible Hand, which is set on an Earth where an alien invasion has made a lot of human jobs redundant, thus causing a global recession, Hamilton plays a father whose family has fallen on hard times, who are taken in by the family of a character played by Tiffany Haddish, because his daughter and her son go to the same school. But instead of appreciating what Haddish's character has done for his family, he grows to resent her for being more well off. And again, it's a performance with a lot of layers where you're never sure, should I like this person? Should I be laughing at this person? Should I be scared of this person? Very compelling. And Landscape in the Invisible Hand is really underrated. It's on Prime Video. And then just briefly about the other performances. I think May-December is an interesting movie because at one level, it's a satire. Because it's about a movie that's being made about a very shocking and infamous court case. And it's trying to be a satire about movies and like media and sensationalism while also
being about Peter
respect to that story. And I think if there might be moments where you think, oh, this is a bit sanitized, or oh, this is being a bit flippant about the subject matter, they're pretty much dispelled by the slow unraveling of the Charles Melton character.
Mm-hmm.
But also Cormac Michael Smith, who has like three scenes as Julianne Moore's son from her first marriage that was blown up when she had this affair. And he is just electric. Like, he shows up into scenes and his whole character is basically like, I know what everyone thinks of me. I know that like what happened was messed up. I'm just going to address it before you even have a chance to address it. And she tries to avoid really being vulnerable. And he just lights up the scenes he's in. He has three scenes, kind of has a brilliant little arc that he sneaks into those three scenes. I thought it was very incredible. He's an actor I've liked quite a bit because he's very good in Carol. And I used to watch Gotham where he played the Riddler. I shouted Forrest Goodluck in How to Blow Up a Pipeline in our end of the year episode.
Yeah.
What I love about the performance is that for whatever reason, his character seems to struggle to connect to others. Like, he's not friendly. He projects this sort of apathetic, above everything energy. But throughout the movie, in the brief moments when he talks about the climate crisis, or when you see him, how angry he is about what's happening in the place where he lives, or you witness him with such intense focus handling this like highly dangerous volatile materials needed to make a bomb, it's clear he cares a huge deal.
Mm.
And that there's a huge wealth of feeling behind him, but he just can't express it in a typical way.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a really unique take on a character that you've sort of seen before in a movie.
Yeah.
Kiefer Sutherland for K. Mutiny Court Martial. This was William Friedkin's final movie, an adaptation of a story that was previously the basis for a Humphrey Bogart movie. Sutherland plays the same role that Bogart did, which is of Lieutenant Commander Queeg, a Navy ship captain who accuses one of his lieutenants of staging mutiny against him. The lieutenant claims that Queeg was showing signs of mental instability. Friedkin's version of the story is set entirely in the courtroom. There's no flashbacks. A lot of the Bogart movies actually sat on the boat.
Right.
Friedkin's version is just people giving testimonies. It's absolutely riveting.
Mm.
And Sutherland has just one long scene at the beginning and one long scene at the end. And over the course of those scenes, he manages to alternate between being commanding, imposing, the sinister and scary, to being pathetic and almost sympathetic. And he's playing a character with nervous tics, and he's doing a little bit of a Bogart impression, you know, with the cadence.
Yeah.
And he still makes it feel natural and like honestly like hypnotic.
Mm.
And then just to add to what you said about Mikado Granier, the fact that he has to reckon with so much, like he's playing a guy who's either the scenario is that his mom killed his dad or that his dad
killed himself.
And maybe because of something that had happened to him.
Mm.
Him reckoning with that, like it's such heavy subject matter to place on a kid, and he absolutely crushes it. And then the fact adding that he's playing like someone with a visual impairment.
Yeah.
It's insane stuff. Mm. I hope he has a great career.
No.
Was there any late cuts for you or anything?
Not really. I'm not a big lists guy, so sure. Whenever you force me to do one, it's like the
bare minimum.
It's like someone has hung a millstone around my neck.
I just will shout out just quickly. I'll run through George McKay, Femme, Harris Dickinson, The Iron Claw, Jamie Bell, All the Strangers, Jonathan Groff, Knock at the Cabin, Jordan Firstman, Rotting in the Sun, Matt Johnson and Michael Ironside in Blackberry, Nathan Lane and Beau's Afraid, Rami Youssef in Poor Things, and Richard E. Grant in Saltburn. I thought they were great. We're going to Best Supporting.
Yes. So, do you want to go again or do will I do it?
You go for it.
Okay. So, the nominees for Best Supporting Actress are Barbara Crampton in Suitable Flesh, Alyssa Sutherland in Evil Dead Rise, Rosamund Pike, Saltburn, Lizzie Kaplan, Cobweb. I don't care if people accuse me of category fraud for that fourth one.
The kid's the lead.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Woody Norman.
Yeah. And
he's my best actor. Rina
Sawayama in John Wick Chapter 4. And the winner is... oh, I forgot we don't have an orchestra. Rina Sawayama, John Wick 4.
Do, 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 do.
Rina Sawayama. Yeah. So the John Wick series is about paying for mistakes, and up to the fourth entry, it's mostly about people paying for the mistakes they made that affected John Wick, played by Keanu Reeves, as we all know. And in John Wick Chapter 4, this thematic plot point is sort of turned on its head, and it's John Wick who must account for the cost of his actions for once. Consequences, as he loves to say. Everyone says that word differently in each character has their own way of intoning consequences, Jonathan. Yeah. You know, stuff like that. And at the center of these consequences is Akira Shimazu, played by Rina Sawayama, who has, up to the point where John arrives on the grounds of the Osaka Continental Hotel, lived a pretty contented life, in assassin terms at least. It's a conflicted role because Akira is bound by duty to her father, Koji, played by Hiroyuki Sanada, back in the news, friend of the pod for Shogun. Yes. But also doesn't see why they have to help a man who Koji's debt to lies years in the past, that thereby sacrificing all that she and her father have fought for. And the film is full of characters like these, each with their own agendas and desires. But I think Akira's is the clearest and also the one that will conflict audiences most. So for three films, we've seen John slaughter his way through armies of goons, relatively consequence-free, minus a finger or a dog or a wife or two. And it's only in Chapter 4's opening act that we see that his actions have dire consequences for others besides him. So Sawayama sells all this really naturally and easily with a distinct glower that never really leaves her face, except for like moments of high emotion. And that consistently communicates her simmering rage that eventually boils over in a heartbreaking display of emotion after the death of her father at the hands of Kane, played by Donnie Yen. And that's all without mentioning the sublime bow work, judo and knife fighting Sawayama does in her one fight scene, and the banger of a song she did for the soundtrack, Eye for an Eye. Spotify it. Great. That bit where she's just climbing up a man's back with knives.
That's the bit I remember. Yeah.
Or she hits a guy with an arrow and it pins him to a wall by his knee, and then he like gets hit with another arrow in the neck. That doesn't pin him to the wall, so he's just swinging on the wall by his knee. Incredible stuff. That's really more directing, but hey, still great.
She was there.
Yeah, she was there. Incredible stuff.
No, for sure.
Yeah.
Might do mine, or do you want to say more about your nominees?
You know what? All of Rosamund Pike's line deliveries in Saltburn, incredible.
Saltburn, I understand if people have issues with Saltburn.
Yeah.
The acting is pretty flawless, I'd say.
Women are so terribly wet. Men are so lovely and dry.
The way where she's talking about common people.
Yeah.
She's like, never once went to Greece, and I don't have a thirst for knowledge.
Alyssa Sutherland, I think, was really good in that. For especially
also got some good line deliveries.
Yeah,
mom is with the maggots now.
good
film. My picks are Alison Oliver / Rosamund Pike, Saltburn; Anne Hathaway / Maren Ireland, Eileen; Pom Clemente from Mission Impossible: Dead Reckoning; Sandra Huller, The Zone of Interest; and Viola Davis, Air. And my winner is Sandra Huller for The Zone of Interest. She's been rightly honored by the Academy for her lead performance in Anatomy of a Fall. On top of this, Zone of Interest, rightly nominated in 5 categories at the Oscars, 1-2. I think it's a tremendous piece of work. And just for those not aware, it follows the Nazi commandant of the Auschwitz concentration camp, Rudolf Hals, played by Christian Friedel, and his wife, Hedwig, Sandra Huller, as they raise a family in their home next to the camp. And the movie's noteworthy because it never shows the horrors of the camp in an explicit visual way. They are only suggested through sounds or through smoke billowing in the distance. And instead, like writer-director Jonathan Glazer, by deploying this observational filmmaking style where there's like fixed cameras and there's like a lack of cutting between scenes, he focuses on these seemingly mundane scenes involving the Haas family, and this creates a disconnect because you know these horrors are happening, but no one is really talking about them, and it's shocking and infuriating, and you want to just scream at the screen for someone to address the matter. And you also start hyper-focusing in on these scenes of inaction, looking for any hint as to how Rudolf Haas and his wife can live like this and how they can be part of such evil, if they feel any guilt at all. And so Glazer turns a lack of narrative action into one of the most haunting, compelling pieces of art I've ever seen. But I think Huller deserves a lot of praise too, because while the film eschews easy answers for those questions I mentioned that the film provokes, there's a lot happening amidst those seemingly workaday scenes of family life, particularly the ones involving Hedwig. I won't go into specifics for people who haven't seen the film, but there are moments of her by herself, or her with her husband, or her with her mother, or her with the staff, where you see like Hedwig has layers, but also Huller never for a second softens her or makes her in any way sympathetic. Like, I can't stress how evil her
she
character
is, vile,
and how awful Rudolf Hals the character is. But I put a lot of how compelling the Hedwig character is on Huller, particularly when you learn that Glazer shot a lot of the film with these hidden cameras, had actors like act out in these long unbroken takes because he wanted to remove the artifice of having conventional film scenes, and I think because he wanted to capture natural raw moments between Huller and Friedle acting out this dysfunctional married couple's lives to make the film feel more real. And apparently there was a lot of improvisation by the actors on set. And I think the two lead performances are scarily authentic.
Yeah.
I just think it's very fearless work by Huller. And it's been so great to see her get her flowers on the international stage for both this and Anatomy of a Fall after years of being so great in, you know, European films like Tony Erdmann or Sybil. Yeah, just Davis quickly. In a similar way to what I said about Charles Belton and Corey Michael Smith and how they like add extra weight to May December, anytime you're watching Air and thinking, it's kind of crazy, I'm watching a movie about the making of a shoe,
yeah.
Viola Davis shows up and adds so much gravitas and stakes playing the mother of basketballer Michael Jordan, who negotiates this deal with Nike for them to build a shoe line around him, like the Air Jordan line. And it's the classic Viola Davis thing where she just effortlessly embodies intelligence and strength. And the best parts of Air are her recognizing how much her son's talent is worth and her fighting on his behalf to make sure he isn't shafted or taken advantage of by this big corporation. Like, she's really the hero of the movie. Clementine, it's been a while just since I've seen a henchwoman or henchman or henchwoman in a movie take so much glee from being a baddie.
Yeah.
But then at the end of the movie, there is a part where she does a huge turn towards good.
And you believe it. Yeah. She really sells it. Yeah,
It's kind of amazing.
But all the bits where she's like driving that massive Hummer through the streets of Rome and just cackling like mad.
Incredible.
Yeah. And the little like tennis skirt as well. It's like, she's got great costumes.
Oh, yeah. The bit with she has the sword fight and the Venice looks incredible too. Yeah, you mentioned Rosamund Pike. I'll just say about Alison Oliver. I watched a bit of Conversations with Friends, the normal people, you know, a follow-up sort of.
Yeah.
And I thought she was the best thing about it in the sort of Daisy Edgar-Jones, Paul Mescal sort of role of introspective, thoughtful person who feels things super deeply. She's like the total opposite in some way.
Not a thought in her head.
Hyper-confident, narcissistic, selfish, but also troubled and perceptive in her own way. Sister of the wealthy Felix, who Barry Keoghan tries to inveigle his way into her
just eat
family.
The fucking pie!
And I think she perfectly embodies this character. It's meant to be kind of alluring and funny, but also very annoying. But also the scene at the end where her and Oliver are having the long conversation and she compares them to a moth and she's like, drawn to shiny things, banging up against a window, begging to be let in. Great stuff,
yeah,
I must say. And I can't believe it's the same person from Conversations with Friends. And I pointed this out to multiple people and they're like, no way, it's her.
Yeah.
So, and then speaking of alluring, Anne Hathaway in Eileen, tasked with basically playing a sort of mysterious noir femme fatale who's so alluring in her confidence, elegance, and power and presence that a person will blow up their life entirely for her. And you completely believe it.
Yeah. not that hard to believe, in fairness. It's Anne Hathaway.
Sure.
Yeah.
But also Maren Ireland from our beloved Empty Man, she, in the movie, plays the mother of a teenager in juvie for killing his father, and the boy is being examined by Anne Hathaway's psychologist character. And Arna has this long, dark monologue towards the end of the movie where she has to play so many emotions simultaneously, and it's electrifying.
As you heard in the intro, this show is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network, Ireland's largest network of independent podcasts. There's plenty of other great shows to check out on the network. Here's a taster of one.
So Gwyneth Paltrow's a pain in the hole. Is that agreed?
I think that's the national consensus on Gwyneth, that she's a melt, she's a pain in the hole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, well, if you're listening and you're interested in who else is a pain in the hole, we have a list.
Oh, we have a list, and it's extensive, and it's growing.
Pains in the hole and the ticks. We have a list of ticks.
Yeah. Hmm. And we'll get into it. And if you don't agree with us, that means that you could be in the list. So you might as well listen.
Yeah, to make sure you're not on the list of ticks.
Yeah.
Or pains in the hole. Somebody used to call me Deirdre O'Pain in the hole.
But you're definitely not a pain in the hole.
I'm not. God, no. Okay. But I am doing a podcast called Keep It Tight with Emma Dorn.
We're here, myself and the queen of comedy, Deirdre O'Kane. We're keeping it tight every week on a Wednesday. Get involved or you'll be on the list.
Yeah, you tick.
I Know That Face are also delighted to finally get to tell listeners about Headstuff Plus. Headstuff Plus is the one-stop shop for everything on the Headstuff Podcast Network, Ireland's largest podcast network and the one to which I Know That Face belongs. If you're a fan of I Know That Face or any other shows on the network, become a member of Headstuff Plus and get bonus episodes of Headstuff shows, other exclusive content, merchandise, early access to live events, and lots more. We here at I Know The Face have already recorded a handful of bonus episodes where myself and Andrew talk about more current news and releases in the world of film and TV. But also in the future, we have plans for more actor-themed series as well, along with releasing episode outtakes, accompanying articles, etc., all for Headstuff Plus subscribers. To sign up to Headstuff Plus, it's just €5 plus VAT per month. When you sign up, no matter what show or shows you are supporting, you still get access to everything. All the bonus material for all the podcasts on the network. A lot of great podcasts. Plus, by doing so, you'll be supporting I Know The Face to bring you more top material. For all the details and to sign up, visit headstuffpodcasts.com.
And now, back to the show.
We move on to next category, which is Best Actor.
Yes, of course. How could I have dared to put Best Actress before that?
Oh, no, it's okay.
No. That was grand. So here are the nominees. Hayley Atwell, Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning. Madeline Una Voiles, The Creator. Lily Gladstone, Killers of the Flower Moon. Lily Sullivan, Evil Dead Rise. Heather Graham, In Suitable Flesh. And the winner is Heather Graham, Suitable Flesh.
That movie is a blast.
It really is a lot of fun, especially like, I'll get into it here, but so I think it's hard enough to portray one believable character, let alone playing a completely different character inside the body of that initial character. Body swap or possession horrors aren't rare, but good ones are becoming more and more scarce in the currently healthy horror landscape. Healthier than ever, some might say. Golden age of slashers, what? Suitable Flesh is one of the good ones, thanks in part to Heather Graham's dynamically unhinged performance as Dr. Elizabeth Derby. And either playing her as a bored but stable psychiatrist or a demented sex freak, Graham convinces us either easily. And considering how the movie and Elizabeth's journey is bookended, it makes for a pretty tragic story, even if the film can be hard to follow if you haven't been invested from the start. So for all the gory violence in Suitable Flesh, there's real care for characters as well, though it's lit and designed, maybe intentionally, like a daytime soap. I believe that all of Suitable Flesh's characters were real people with flaws and qualities that made them relatable despite the cosmic horror body swapping. That bit where her husband has cooked a fish and he's like, a bream for thee.
Yes. He's so funny in the
movie. He is really good, yeah. And really good looking.
Yeah, it's true.
Real silver fox. And it's always interesting to see a woman playing someone possessed by a man's soul or mind or whatever is possessing her. And Graham's movements are looser and more aggressively confident compared to Dr. Turby's prim, proper and more put together personality. And it's the performance that the film hangs really well on.
Yeah. I've always liked her. And it's,
me too, yeah.
I think...
seemed to have a bit of a falling off in the last few years or something. But
I think... I know that wasn't Stuart Gordon, but it was his frequent collaborator who wrote that movie, and it's based off a H.P. Lovecraft story. And I think her becoming a sort of Barbara Crampton-y kind of figure as she gets older is a good fit.
Yeah. Handy that Barbara Crampton is also in the movie. Yeah.
And they play
in a movie that looked like a daytime soap.
Yes. I'm looking at, my picks for Best Actor. Andrew Scott, All the Strangers. Glenn Harrodin, Blackberry. Joel Edgerton, Master Gardener. Mahershala Ali, Leave the World Behind. Nicolas Cage, Dream Scenario. My pick is Mahershala Ali for Leave the World Behind.
I knew this already. Why am I acting surprised?
This was a role that was initially going to be played by Denzel Washington, but when he dropped out, writer-director Sam Esmail said, get me another actor with two Oscars, damn it. As I kind of said in our Best of the Year episode, I feel like Leave the World Behind elevates the sci-fi horror disaster stories in the vein of Bird Box and The Happening to high art through its emphasis on character, its capturing of a feeling of conspiracy and doom in the air today, and by just casting multiple Oscar winners and nominees in the leading roles. And Ali's character, G.H., is the most important part of the movie. Amidst this apocalypse occurring, he's this intelligent, warm, highly resourceful person who, despite all these positive qualities, you always have a feeling is maybe hiding something or maybe letting on that he knows less than what he really knows. And he also has to play the switch from, this is weird, but I'm sure this is going to be okay, to the increased paranoia that it's not, and that he'll never be reunited with his wife who's out of the country on work. And he also plays a money manager to the very wealthy in the film. So he knows a lot about how the world works. So he's sort of the exposition machine in the film. And he manages, just through his natural gravitas, he has a very regal quality, I always find. To be in those scenes of explaining, so commanding and electric and natural. There's a long scene...
The thing about owning a Learjet is... et cetera, et cetera.
Yes. There's a long scene in Leave the World Behind where it's just Ali's character telling a story to Julia Roberts' character over drinks. And it goes from being funny and they're kind of flirty to disquieting and ominous, to actually scary, and then back to funny. And it's just him telling a story. And I rewatched the scene twice in prep for this, and it still gives me goosebumps. Scott's the more conventional pick for this, but since I'm going to be honouring all of the strangers later in another category, and I'm such a genre head, I'm going to give it to Ali. And I know he has two Oscars, he still feels underrated to me.
Yeah, very much so.
Maybe it's because he came famous late in his career and he hasn't made a lot of movies since Green Book, although he was in a great True Detective season. But I love him so much.
Yeah.
And then just briefly, I want to shout out Edgerton in The Master Gardener. Paul Schrader's, his final part of his late period trilogy of men with weird jobs that serve as a metaphor facing an existential crisis and journaling as they do so. We've had Ethan Hawke in First Reformed, Oscar Isaac in The Card Counter. Although this character Schrader does goes back to his screenplay for Taxi Driver. But Joel Edgerton's character is probably the weirdest of all of these characters in that he's a former neo-Nazi who's changed his ways by becoming a gardener and is tasked with mentoring a young black woman played by Quintessa Swindell. And they fall in love with each other. He's the kind of guy who says things like, "The Nandina is a species of flowering plant native to Eastern Asia. The smell at certain times of the year gives you a real buzz, like the buzz you get just before you pull the trigger." And yet, Joel Edgerton, one of our most underrated actors and filmmakers, makes you really believe in him. He'll do something weird and you're just like, ah, classic yeah. Norval. His character's name is Norval. Harridan, one of our great screamer actors, kind of all he has to do in Blackberry, but in It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, he was always the fool. In here, he's actually genuinely sort of menacing and scary. Yeah. And like, I would not like to be in a room with that man. So
two wars!
Do you ever been in a storm, Wally? That's another clip of him. I love him. It's Always Sunny. And then, Nicolas Cage in Dream Scenario. It's just been so great having Nicolas Cage escape from direct-to-DVD jail and actually get to do some good character work. And, in a film made by talented artists with the means to support him. So, recent years, you have Mandy, Clear Out of Space, Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. I thought he's pretty amazing, if severely underused, in Renfield, playing Dracula.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. There's an interesting film in there. Yeah, just not what
didn't
was
find
made.
It. But in Dream Scenario, he plays a schlubby, nerdy, unremarkable college professor who becomes an unconventional celebrity because he starts appearing in other people's dreams. Such transformative work, really disappears into the character just through awkward posture and the nervous energy he conjures up when his character is so desperate. His character is real desperate to be liked or to be seen as impressive by others that he constantly was making a fool of himself. There's like, he'd be telling a funny story and he's like, as he's telling, like hyping it up. And he's always trying to think of like a witty comeback to say and then like completely flubs it. It's so funny. And I like highbrow comedy. Like, I don't usually go in for puerile gags. There is a scene involving farting in Dream Scenario. One of the funniest things I've ever seen in a film that I think is pretty good that maybe runs out of steam.
Yeah.
Yes. So will we move on to Best Actress?
Yeah.
I want to shout
out. Which is what I just did.
Sorry, my bad.
So you go ahead with...
I was going to say, late cuts for Best Actor though. Zac Efron, Iron Claw, Russell Crowe, Pope's Exorcist, Seydou Sarr in Io Capitano, and Ben Platt in Theatre Camp are the performances I'd... You want me to do Best Actress?
Yeah, you do Best Actress, and then I'll do Best Actor, and then we'll move on to the screenplays.
Sure. Best Actress... Laurie Calamy, full-time. Cassandra Nod, influencer. Sydney Sweeney, reality. Tamisha McKenzie, Eileen. Anjanae Ellis-Taylor, origin. And my winner is Calamy.
Yeah.
I remember a quote about a director casting Rutger Hauer in A Quiet Italian Drama and saying to him, like, this is an action movie, but the action is taking place behind your eyes. And that's what Laurie Calamy brings to full-time. She's aided with some dynamic direction and propulsive music on the soundtrack, but she basically turns a Ken Loach-esque story about a single mother living on the outskirts of Paris with a stressful job in the city, trying to keep her family afloat in the middle of a train strike, into just one of the most stressful movies I've seen in ages. And I don't know if you're familiar with her. She's like a primarily comedic actress. Like, she's in Call My Agent. She had supporting roles in some great French movies in recent years, like Only the Animals and Sybil with Sandra Hüller. So naturally likable, and the last scene in the movie is a long take of her having a very emotional reaction to receiving some news, and it's one of the most memorable final scenes I've seen in forever. So really like that. Influencer, that's Cassandra Nod in Influencer is probably the weirdest pick on my list, given it was in a Shudder exclusive release. But it's like one of those psychological thrillers like Blank from Hell. It's like friend you meet on holiday from hell, essentially. Yeah. But it's about an social influencer who, while on holiday in Thailand, makes a friend, played by Nod, who may have a sinister agenda. Very fun, watchable movie with some flaws. But Nod is a really interesting villain. She has an MO that involves her taking on a lot of different identities, so that's fun from a performance perspective. And it's been a while since I've seen it, but I don't think you ever really get an explanation of why the character does what she does. But I think there's a lot that you can infer from Nod's performance. So she adds a lot to it. Yeah. So I can't wait to see her in other projects. I feel like if I'm going to nominate Anne Hathaway for Eileen in supporting, you have to nominate Tamisha McKenzie in...
The lead,
because the two can't exist without each other. Like, she's sort of everything that Anne Hathaway is not, but she wants to become like her.
Yeah.
the kind of person who this her dad in the movie says to her, played by Shea Whigham, some people, they're the real people, like in a movie. They're the ones you're watching. They're the ones making moves. And the other people, they're just filling the space. You take them for granted. You think, they're easy. Take a penny, leave a penny. That's you.
Jesus.
Yeah. I mean, rules, by the way. It's really, really good. But she does a great job of playing this person who lets people treat her like a doormat, who gradually reveals this inner power or strength, albeit in unconventional ways. And then... yeah, Sydney Sweeney is obviously a star. Anyone who's seen Euphoria or The White Lotus or my favorite of hers, the erotic thriller The Voyeurs on Prime Video. But reality really shows.
Of course it's an erotic thriller.
The same director is making the new movie Immaculate.
Of course.
Yeah. But this shows...
What am I saying? She's really hot. Of course.
She's a great actress, though. This shows that she has more strings to her bow. She's very well cast in reality as this person who seems like the perfect all-American and patriot who probably because of this felt compelled to leak a document, a leak that the US government was not happy about. And you forget you're watching Sydney Sweeney and she just completely disappears into character. And also, like Josh Hamilton, is on this weird length or weird wavelength of the movie where the loud thing isn't being said out loud.
You're right. Yeah.
So, which I thought was impressive. Yeah. That's all my picks.
My nominees for Best Actor are Patrick Dempsey, Thanksgiving, Christian Friedel, The Zone of Interest, Ryunosuke Kamiki, Godzilla Minus One, Cillian Murphy, Oppenheimer, and Koji Yakusho in Perfect Days. Yeah, so the winner is Koji Yakusho. Nuance is a hard one thing in cinema, and it's easy to go for the simple things, to go big or go home, but small, understated performances that build into something real and relatable are the ones that knock me over. And that's what Koji Yakusho does as Hirayama, a Japanese toilet cleaner living a simple, ordered life in Tokyo, relatively free of the earthly complications that bother the average person. But when those complications come in to the film, they hit like hammer blows. And so as Hirayama's past is partly revealed and more often only hinted at, you get the sense that this simple, inexpensive life is intentional because his past was so complicated. So an abusive parent is revealed as the reason for his isolation and solitary life. He only ever orders ice water at his nightly and weekly restaurant visits, suggesting that, you know, he was an addict in a past life, perhaps, or an alcoholic. He yearns to connect with people but finds it difficult because of how badly he's been hurt before. That doesn't stop him from looking after his runaway niece. There are moments where he's left speechless by emotion when confronted by his sister or as he drives into the sunrise in the film's final scene. And that's all without mentioning the great bits of physical comedy that happens throughout the movie. Yakusho expresses just so much with his face, like his reaction to getting kissed on the cheek, where he's like, oh! And then the woman dodges out of the van, accidentally falling down the stairs after walking in on his niece getting changed. Well, he doesn't walk in on her getting changed. That sounds kind of pervy. She starts getting changed in front of him. He's like, ah! Falls down the stairs backwards. Or he's always exchanging suspicious glances with a woman he eats lunch beside every day. And it's really lived performance, full of like the everyday joy and suffering we all experience, but also rarely accurately depicted. And with this, 13 Assassins and Cure, Yakusho shows he is one of the best, most nuanced living actors.
I didn't realize he was the same actor.
Yeah, yeah. It's the grey and the hair.
I need to watch Perfect Days. I haven't seen it yet.
It's really, really good. Great. Yeah. Yeah, and I think Christian Friedel deserves sort of a special mention for playing such a sort of repulsive man who is just sort of incapable of reckoning, at least on any kind of conscious level, with what he's done or what he's doing, I suppose.
The scene where he's at the party and he says that thing on the phone is chilling.
Yeah.
It is a very good performance.
And the bit at the end of the movie where he has this the vision, I guess you call it, and he's like vomiting, but you can tell in his head it's like that thought has just left, and he's like, "Whoa, must have had too much to drink." Back to bed.
See, the genius is the cut back, where if it had ended in the flashback, I was like, "Oh, that's a very powerful ending." Yeah. But the fact that it cuts back, that's genius.
Yeah.
I just actually realized I never shouted out Ellis Taylor from Origin. That movie has similar topic to Zone of Interest in that it follows the real life author Isabel Wilkerson, who's played by Ellis Taylor, who, while dealing with several personal tragedies, does research for her nonfiction book Cast, which examines the treatment of Black people in America, the treatment of Jewish people in Nazi Germany, and the treatment of the Dalit people in India, and finds parallels. Very ambitious film with some powerful scenes. You can feel Ava DuVernay trying to turn an academic text into a movie that works dramatically. It doesn't totally work for me, but when it did, it was because of Ellis Taylor being so raw and emotionally vulnerable. So just wanted to shout that out.
Yeah.
Do we just fly through, since we got the acting out of the way, we just fly through the rest of the characters?
Yeah, sounds good. Yeah.
So my best adapted screenplay nominations are All of Us Strangers, written by Andrew Hay, Bird Box Barcelona, written by Alex Pastor and David Pastor, Blackberry, written by Matt Johnson and Matthew Miller, Leave the World Behind, written by Sam Asmail, and Theatre Camp, written by Noah Galvin, Molly Gordon, Nick Lieberman, and Ben Platt. Bird Box Barcelona is like a trolley nomination, but the screenplay does pull off a cool trick I've never seen before. Do you know the plot of Bird Box? People getting terrorized by an unseen force. When the people lock eyes with this unseen force, they're either driven to hurt themselves or driven to basically do the entity's bidding and force other humans to open their eyes and be exposed to them. In the original Bird Box, before they kind of know that's what's happening, Sandra Bullock holds up in a house with a bunch of strangers, and a character played by Tom Hollander shows up at the door begging for help. They let him in. Bad news, he was a seer, which is what they call him. Chaos ensues. I'm going to spoil the opening act of Bird Box Barcelona, but anyone who really cared would have watched already, like I did, the second I got a press screener. It moves the action to Spain, and we follow who we think is the sort of Sandra Bullock surrogate. He's the Spanish guy with a daughter who comes across a gang of thieves, or it comes across a gang of survivors living in a big bus and is taken in by them. It's very The Walking Dead. He then proceeds to drive and crash the bus while they're all sleeping, leaving all the survivors being trapped outside in the open without blindfolds, and they all die horribly. He's not the Sandra Bullock, he's the Tom Hollander. And
he, shoes on the other foot.
Exactly. And we basically watch him join other groups of survivors and get them killed until he forms a connection with a survivor played by Georgina Campbell from Barbarian, who makes him try to fight back against the entity for control of his body and humanity. I liked it all the way through. It gets a little silly towards the end, but that first act around that rug pull is incredible. Anyway, my winner is Blackberry. Blackberry's great, delivers all the same thrills The Social Network and Steve Jobs of men talking about tech jargon like it's the most important thing in the world, while also underlaying that with a extremely funny but not condescending comedy, because after all, Blackberry's bubble burst was spectacular. And it's also just filled with like amazing little details to signpost like its big character acts, like J. Burchell's slow compromising his ideals and the distrust that grows between him and the Glenn Harrington character. Really good. I also really like Theatre Camp.
I hear it's great.
Mainly just for being, it does a great job satirizing Theatre Camps while also treating them with great love and reverence. And you think you're kind of watching a hangout mockumentary, and then it all leads to this musical number that's inspired by things that have happened in the movie already, and it pays off like a slot machine.
Okay.
Like, it's really, really great. What about you?
Yeah. So my nominees are Dennis Pauly, Suitable Flesh, Christopher Nolan for Oppenheimer, Andrew Kevin Walker for The Killer, and Martin Scorsese and Eric Roth for The Killers of the Flower Moon, and Takashi Yamazaki for Godzilla Minus One. It'll surprise no one, my winner is Godzilla Minus One.
Hey!
So I'm a big sucker for Big G. I'm an even bigger sucker for a well-written Big G movie, and Godzilla Minus One is certainly that. From the word go, Yamazaki's script just moves. Similar to Top Gun Maverick, it's taking an old classic and making it feel new again, but Minus One doesn't feel the need to step into the modern world to do it. Instead, it goes further back to 1947, consistently ramps up the stakes and introduces us to a group of likeable characters, all with their own quirks, qualities, and foibles. And then it puts them all inside a new nuclear nightmare. Yamazaki wears his inspirations on his sleeve, pulling from Jaws, Jurassic Park, Dunkirk, as well as the original Godzilla, in crafting some unbelievable sequences that feel new in his hands. For the first time in 10 years, ever since he put his foot down at Honolulu Airport in Gareth Edwards' 2014 Godzilla, The King of the Monsters feels frightening and awe-inspiring again. And though it's far removed from the realm of reality, Godzilla Minus One feels like a perfect companion piece to Oppenheimer.
Yeah, I still haven't seen it, but I would like to.
Yeah, it's great.
We do original screenplay. I'm actually realizing we're actually running out of time, and I'm actually getting new appreciation for Jimmy Kimmel, where I'm like, it actually is hard to host this do an Oscars. Best original screenplay. I'll just talk about my winner. Fair Play, written by Chloe Dumont. Fallen Leaves, written by Aki Kaurismäki. The Iron Claw, written by Sean Durkin. The Royal Hotel, written by Kitty Green and Oscar Redding. And You Hurt My Feelings, written by Nicole Holofcener. My winner is You Hurt My Feelings. I'm in awe of how this movie, like how Nicole Holofcener wrote a whole delightful comedy film about an author overhearing her husband say he doesn't like her new book. That's the whole movie. The whole plot spirals out of that, but it's so well observed and the characters are so well drawn and it's so funny in its observations of the life of a couple who know each other too well and maybe are grown a little bit complacent. It's really, really good. And while you're watching it, you just be nowhere else.
Yeah. So, yeah. That's the one of Tobias Menzies, isn't it?
Tobias Menzies.
Tobias Menzies. So, my nomination for Best Original Screenplay, I only have four for some reason. There's Lee Cronin, Evil Dead Rise. Damien Rugna, When Evil Lurks. Hayao Miyazaki, The Boy and the Heron, aka How Do You Live? And Win Vendors, Takuma Takasaki for Perfect Days. And the winner is, again, it'll surprise no one, Evil Dead Rise.
Way!
The trouble with the locked room mystery, or massacre in this case, is the script's ability to make you care about every character. Luckily, Evil Dead Rise doesn't have that problem. Writer and director Lee Cronin wastes little time in creating a bad situation and then turns it into a hellish nightmare complete with Chekhov's vinyl record, Chekhov's cheese grater, Chekhov's shotgun, and Chekhov's wood shredder, all of which appear in the final act. Well, maybe not the vinyl record, but anyway. Each character is distinct and easy to root for, and so are the ways they are killed. Whether it's a deadite getting impaled through the mouth on a sharp stick topped with a doll's head called Staffney, a guy choking to death on his friend's eyeball, or the scalping that begins the film, Cronin has no shortage of tricks in his box, in his toy box. It's a film with one foot in Sam Raimi's shadow and another in its own syrupy thick puddle of blood.
Very good. Yeah. Best director? I'm going to go Andrew Hay, All the Strangers. Ari Aster, Beau's Afraid. Daniel Goldhaber, How to Blow Up a Pipeline. Sofia Coppola, Priscilla. Tina Satter, Reality. He's not my winner, but I just want to say Ari Aster, the first hour of Beau's Afraid is incredible and is so tense and taut and funny and really feels like what having anxiety feels like. He conjured on screen. I think that movie loses a little bit of steam from that point on, though. So my winner is Sofia Coppola, Priscilla. I think the story that they're telling in Priscilla is quite a complex, difficult story to tell, and I think Sofia Coppola tells it in a way that feels incredibly authentic but never manipulative. And I think as I'm getting older, I'm starting to realize that how to tell a great director from maybe a not so good director is like how much emotion can they evoke by doing less, like a simple camera move or even just like a bit of b-roll. How does that push the story forward? How does it make the audience feel? And I think Sofia Coppola is incredible at that, and I think
so is Michael Bay.
But I think Sofia Coppola movies often get accused of being a little bit restrained or maybe a little bit too quiet and internal. But I think oftentimes they linger in the head, and years later, people are like, no, that was the exact right amount of, that was the exact right approach.
Yeah.
So I really like Priscilla for that reason. Yeah. What about you?
My nominees are Christopher McQuarrie for Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning, Wim Wenders for Perfect Days, David Fincher for The Killer, Lee Cronin again for The Evil Dead Rise, and Chad Stahelski for John Wick Chapter 4. And the winner is Chad Stahelski for John Wick Chapter 4. There are a lot of sequences in John Wick Chapter 4 that would earn Stahelski the Snowy. The top-down incendiary shotgun fight, the nightclub brawl, the hotel fight, the climax in Paris. But it's the sheer myth-making power of the film that earns Chad Stahelski this award. From the hammer blows of fists on wood that are the most definitely powerful part of a film that echoes with gunfire and the screams of wounded men at the start. If John Wick Chapter 3 Parabellum was the preparation for war described in that film's subtitle, then John Wick Chapter 4 is the war film the series has been preparing us for. For all its dense world-building lore and diverse cast of characters, John Wick Chapter 4 is the first film in the series to put actual weight behind the already heavy word consequences. Thematically, it's a Greek tragedy told in a world similar yet oh so different from our own, but it has so much more grace than those old brutal stories. And Stahelski deftly wraps up old narrative threads and relationships like John and Winston, played by Ian McShane, while delicately centering new stories like Kane's, played by Donnie Yen, conflict between fighting his old friend John and saving his daughter from certain death. I'm never going to argue against more John Wick movies, but if this is the last main one, I'm glad it ended the way it did.
Best picture.
The
big one.
The big one.
My nominees are All the Strangers, Eileen, Fallen Leaves, How to Blow Up a Pipeline, Yo Capitano, The Iron Claw, The Killer, Leave the World Behind, Priscilla, The Royal Hotel. My winner is All the Strangers.
Nice.
Tagline for...
A quiet, reserved choice from Stephen Porzio.
it's a beautiful movie. Tagline for this movie was... tagline for After Sun was Memory Burns, but I think that could equally apply here to another Paul Mescal movie. Just such incredible work at capturing and articulating both how it feels to be an adult recalling your childhood and how even the smallest interactions you have with your parents can really linger with you, like the impact your parents have on your life or your guardians. It's incredibly emotional that way, but I never felt manipulative or maudlin. And I know some people have issues with the ending, thinking it might be too downbeat. I actually think it's an incredibly powerful ending that is more open-ended than people give it credit for. And I think even if you have a dark interpretation of that ending, just the way it's staged and the music and the visuals are stunning and beautiful. And it's very just stylish and vibey movie. Like, the music for this class, a great way to get into my heart is having a banger soundtrack. And I've listened to the All the Strangers soundtrack nonstop since I've seen it. There's an amazing club scene where Blur, a song plays Death of the Party. And I love the story's unique take on ghosts, which really subverted my expectations. And I think the four leads are all no perfect. It really guts me that I didn't nominate Jamie Bell. Now I'm thinking about it. Because there's a point where his voice cracks when he's saying something to his son and it left me bawling. also, just want to share, I think Io Capitano, which basically is it's an Italian movie. Its title is kind of a joke. It's like a mispronunciation of My Captain, but it's about two young boys, I think from Senegal, who basically try to emigrate into Italy through the Sahara and run into loads of trouble. Really incredible movie. It's like a social realist drama that's more tense than most thrillers and more horrifying than most horror movies.
Right.
And I think it's a movie that they should literally show in schools in terms of like compassion and empathy for people who come from other places.
Yeah.
What about yourself?
Yeah. So my nominations are Godzilla Minus One, Evil Dead Rise, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning, John Wick Chapter 4, Perfect Days, The Killer, Asteroid City, Suitable Flesh, Oppenheimer, and Anatomy of a Fall. And the winner is Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning. Who knew Pom Clementif could be so viciously mean? Who knew Shea Whigham's hair could do that? Who knew so many beautiful people could fit on screen at any one time? I'll tell you who knew. Tom Cruise and Christopher McQuarrie. It's up to us to correct the Academy's omissions, which is why I'm picking a film that on release already felt like the shaggy director's cut version of a much neater but somehow not as good movie. It's our job to highlight the less popular movies that made $500 million globally this year and give them awards over more important and more insular films. Take your bow, McQuarrie and Cruise. Great movie. Yeah.
We did it.
We did it.
And
only 5 minutes over time.
Yes, exactly. email iknowthatfacepod@gmail.com if you'd like to reach out to the show. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. Please leave us an iTunes rating if you'd be so kind. For those who want more of the pod, sign up to Heads Up Plus for just €5 plus tax a month, where you can listen to exclusive bonus episodes of the show. Andrew, where can people find more of your work?
Find me at the Heads Up Gaming section, where we talk about what we play, why we play and how we play it, and at www.fortnitefrights.wordpress.com, talking about horror, the most influential horror movies of the last 100 years.
You can check me out at joe.e. Please read my long interview I did with Armando Iannucci about his new show Dr. Strangelove that's coming to the Borgash next year. It was a really fun interview. See you later, cinephiles.
Bye bye.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Headstuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.